Support for the Projection Booth podcast comes from Stitcher Smart Radio. Now podcast listeners can access the latest episodes of the Projection Booth and thousands of other podcasts on the go without downloading or syncing. Stitcher instantly delivers episodes of your favorite shows to your mobile phone. Stitcher Smart Radio can be found in the iPhone and Android app stores or on the web at stitcher.com/booth.
Night by the fire, please. We just finished with our chauffeur, and now I'll talk about him, father, and the old days. It was more difficult than I had imagined. Mother had made everything sound easy, but the chauffeur was incredibly strong. He had to be stabbed 5 times. In the end, he ran screaming with a knife in his belly and splattered blood all over our house. When we buried him, he was still alive.
That little whore, said petite pute, I'm talking about that bitch daughter of mine. She thinks I have no idea of what happened. Well, I heard it all, and tomorrow we'll have it out. Now we want to know, which train did Laura take? How long did she stay at the lake house? Who broke the radio? And why didn't she hear the news of her death? These are my questions, and I think they're yours as well.
Welcome to the Projection Booth. Joining me is my partner in crime, Mr. Rob St. Mary.
I think I need a shower.
Golden or Roman?
That surprised me.
Along for the ride this week also is Fraulein Von B.
Good evening, gentlemen. How are you?
This week we're talking about Singapore Sling, the 1990 film from director Nikos Nikolaidis, a perverse mystery about a mother and daughter who enjoy killing their servants and playing sex games. They're visited by a private detective who they call Singapore Sling. What else can I say? The film's a little bit of a sequel to Otto Preminger's 1944 film Laura, and I'm hoping that we can kind of unwrap this mystery as we plunge into this discussion. So, Fraulein, I know you recently indulged in this film for the first time. What was your initial reaction?
My initial reaction to this film was, what the f***? That literally is all I could truly say about my first impression. That was, it's definitely a movie I had to watch again right after the first time I saw it. I thought it was dark. I thought it was also very humorous because there were some mildly humorous moments, but I also thought it was done very well. It's now definitely one of my most favorite films to own. I've been watching it a lot, and I've been introducing it to other people. And of course, their first impression is, what the f***? And I actually consider that a compliment. And the more I watched it, the more I really got into the story. And it is in the style of a classic mystery, except for this one has, you know, sadomasochism, torture, incest, and whatnot. So it's just a little different, but it's fun nonetheless.
Well, I agree with her. You know, it is children's programming, and because it is children's programming, I really enjoy it. No, it's I think I told you this, Mike, after you sent it to me to watch. It's almost as if John Waters was directing a 1940s film, but it was shot by Guy Madden. It has this real sort of the era look and film noir sensibility that reminds me of, like, the way Guy Madden shoots things, but with sort of that early 70s perversity of where John Waters originally was, where he was doing all this weirdness with sort of sexuality and people who revel in their dirtiness, I guess, for lack of a better.
The more I watch this film, the more I get out of it. The first time I saw it, I really enjoyed it, and just something about it, I guess it was the visual style and also the storytelling, the way that it kind of plays with the medium a little bit. I mean, there are parts where the actresses kind of trip over their own lines, and I don't know if that's purpose or accidental, and there are other parts where you get multiple takes of the same thing going on, and that definitely is on purpose.
Quelque chose de très important. Some very important things happened late last night. Quelque chose de très important. Some very important things happened late last night. The police came looking for someone called Singapore Sling. Bien sûr, nous avons dit que nous ne savions rien. We said we didn't know anything. They believe us and left.
That plus... Yeah, you don't really get to see too many films with so many perverse acts that just kind of add to the flavor of the film the way that this one does.
And it's not porn either. I mean, it's like the perversity is there, but it's not really there for titillation. It's there for plot, and it's there for almost humor.
Clearly, just like our discussion with Salo, sex was not necessarily the focal point. It is a key element in the relationship between the mother and the daughter, which we will tap into later. But the movie did not rely so much on actual sex. There is some implications, clearly, and there are some scenes where you briefly see it for just a split second, but again, it has really nothing to do with the story itself. It's just, you know, filler here and there. So that's what I also liked about it too.
I like that it's three characters. Each one, I mean, English is the primary language, even though the mother speaks a lot of French, tends to say stuff in French and then repeat it in English. Then we've got Singapore Sling, the detective who shows up, who only speaks Greek. So we have this kind of disconnect in everyone's language as we're going through this film, and just this kind of weird, like, chamber piece where we have the interactions of such a small group. I mean, we start off with the mother and daughter burying the chauffeur, who you don't really see, but we get the daughter telling us that, and she kind of leads us through a lot of the story, but then the mother will take over the narration at times too, and actually they'll kind of tell you what's happened while it's going on, which is kind of neat. And we get moments where they're directly addressing the camera and talking about, you know, all the things that are going on in the house. Like, there's one part where they talk about how they were interrupted by the bell ringing, and that's when the bell is actually ringing at that particular moment. And I believe that's when Singapore Sling shows up, who is looking for Laura. He has a notebook where he has written stuff about Laura, but he really never kind of connects to the mother and daughter. They never understand what he's saying, and I don't know if he understands what they're saying.
I think that's a good twist, because again, the narrator, or in this case, Singapore Sling, only speaks in Greek. The daughter does not speak a lick of French, but... Well, in the film she doesn't, but she definitely understands her mother passively when her mothers would say something in French and she would answer in English, kind of like how I am with my mother with the Russian. And then you have the mother, like you said, who speaks in French but immediately says something in English, so that even the language itself shows a disconnect. And I think that's what would add to Singapore Sling's confusion and anxiety, is that he really has very little idea of what is going on or what the family has in store for him. He's pretty much on his own. He's doing whatever it takes to survive.
You know, I forgot one important character. I said that there are only three, but there's actually a fourth character who we see briefly, but he's mostly just talked about, and that is the father character. Mm-hmm. And I want to say that it's the same guy who played Singapore Sling was playing the father, but you can't really tell because he's wrapped up like a mummy.
Yeah. Again, I think the reason why you don't see the father is wrapped up as a mummy to represent the fact that he's dead. And you don't really see his face or anything because, again, he's an afterthought. He's only mentioned, but he doesn't really have much to do with the story or the lives of the daughter and the mother. All we know is that he died. Somehow they don't even explain that. That leaves the daughter and the mother alone. And I guess that's what adds to their somewhat abusive, manipulative, and also clearly sexual relationship between the two of them. You know, there's really no men around because they're killing them all. And so they're left to their own devices.
I also kind of got the feeling that maybe the father had been abusive towards the daughter, incestuous as well, and then the mother is kind of carrying it on in some way.
That clearly is. Perhaps the mother was also very cruel to her daughter because she could have been jealous the whole time. Not only, she wasn't so much as shocked to know that her husband was perhaps molesting the daughter, but also jealous at the same time. You know, she obviously wasn't getting any. So maybe the reason why in the beginning, when they're playing the game of the secretary, the daughter says, please, mommy, don't hurt me. You hurt me last time and whatnot. I think the mother resents the daughter because, you know, she is beautiful and she is sweet. And there's an innocence to her, and that clearly drew the father into abusing her and whatnot. So it's, again, part of the twisted dynamic between the two. You know, people like myself or like you two, you know, if you found out something like that was happening, you would be shocked and appalled. This woman was purely jealous. That also goes to show what we were, you know, what we're watching and what we could be dealing with.
There are times, though, where I wonder if these two women really are mother and daughter, or if that's just kind of these roles that they're playing, because I know that the daughter kind of shifts between playing herself as the daughter and then also playing Laura. There are times where, you know, there's the secretary game where she does, you know, say, oh, I'm Laura Hunt, you know, Laura, if you please. But then later on, when she's talking to Singapore Sling, she kind of shifts between the two things. Sometimes she speaks as if she were Laura, and then other times she speaks as if she were the daughter, which is interesting. And then the other thing I wanted to say really fast is it's a very nice thing that they talk about the father so often, but we don't see him. It's kind of another nod back to Preminger's Laura, where they talk about Laura so much, but she's kind of absent through a lot of the film, and she's represented by the painting, and it was nice that they had the painting of the daughter there as well in the same kind of pose, which was kind of cool.
Well, I can see how when you look at the way they interact and the way things play out throughout the film, that maybe it is a role play, that maybe they are lovers and not indeed mother and daughter, and they're just putting on an act.
I think they're mother and daughter. I think that gives it a little bit more oomph to the film. That's the impression I have, that it's just a very, very strange, unconventional family. That's just me. I go for the perverse.
Yeah, I haven't gone so far as to look up their ages to see if there's just a few years between them, but they look similar age. I know that the mother definitely, you know, with her overabundance of eye makeup and ton of jewelry and everything, that she definitely looks a little bit older. But yeah, I was wondering if there's that big of an age difference. You know, I really have to say Meredith Harold as the daughter puts in such a great performance. I really wish I could see more of her stuff, but she's only been in like six things that I can find.
This is the only film that I've seen her in, and I thought the performance was done very well, in fact, by all three of them. So if you happen to find anything else of hers, you know, shoot it my way.
Well, I know that the mother, Michelle Valley, she was in Dogtooth, which is an amazing film. I don't know if either of you guys have seen that one.
I know that it played in Detroit at the Burton Theater when the Burton Theater was still on, and I was going to go see it, but I never got over there.
I highly recommend it. It is another kind of interesting, I mean, really kind of plays well with Singapore Sling, because it's this kind of insular family. It's this mom and dad who have, I believe it's three children, and they basically don't want the kids interacting with the outside world whatsoever. So they have done all these things to basically terrorize the kids and keep them from even wanting to go outside. And at one point, one of the daughters gets a hold of a VHS tape of Jaws, and it just kind of rocks her world. It's a very interesting film. I highly recommend it. And again, it's Greek, and this time it's 100% Greek. There's no English going on in it.
There are subtitles, right?
There are subtitles, yes.
Yay, thank goodness. I don't mind reading.
Yeah, and there's only one set of subtitles instead of the double subtitles that we get with Singapore Sling, because of the burned-in subs that were on the original print. Those were illegible sometimes, so they had to kind of go in and redo some of the subtitles. But that was just weird, the timing on the version that I saw. Sometimes they'd pop off and you'd see the originals, and then they'd pop back on. It was just like, what the hell's going on? But that's just kind of added to the whole oddness of the film for me, kind of.
I liked it.
So do you guys think that the sex adds to the story? Does it tell us about the characters while they're having sex?
I think, especially during the game of the secretary, how the mother is dominating the daughter when the daughter's portraying Laura, I think sex is used as not just for pleasure, it's also used for control. At least that's the impression that I had gotten, that it's a love-hate sort of thing when it comes to the sex. Sex is used to control, sex is used to manipulate, get what you want, and so forth. Clearly, the daughter is always trying to copulate with Singapore Sling, and I think it's because, you know, clearly she is very attracted to the man, she wants to be with the man, and I think that's exactly why she suddenly says, well, it's me, I'm Laura. She's pretending to be Laura as a means of escape, to get away from her evil, manipulating, molesting mother.
As Fräulein was going through the list of all the ways that sex is used in the film, I go, how is that different from reality? Used to manipulate and get what you want.
Well, very much so.
And I wonder if she's kind of gotten so used to some of the perversity around the house that, you know, the first time that she's having sex with Singapore Sling, she induces vomiting.
Not to yuck someone's yum, as we say in the industry. I think it's just, so it's definitely something a lot of people get off on. Roman showers are quite popular, so I think that was just her means of excitement. I really have no other way of describing the induced sexual emesis. Some people get a kick out of it. I just like the fact that he's just lying there with that expression on his face, like, what just happened?
You really start to feel for Singapore Sling after a while.
Yes, not just the character, but that actor, that takes cojones más grandes to be able to lie there. It's like, okay, you're going to be chained to a bed. You're going to be shocked with electroshock therapy machines from back in the day. You're going to be puked on. You're going to be force-fed.
You're going to be peed on.
Oh, yes, you're going to be peed on. And he's probably just like, yeah, sure.
As long as the check's cash.
You know what I call that?
A Thursday night.
There you go.
I thought that was a very interesting part because you never really get to see that. That's definitely something that most people try to shy away from. Even though if it's not your bag, it's very interesting to actually see that. And for a while, you know, I was having debates with my primary, you know, do you think that vomit was real? Do you think she really made herself puke? And we're both saying, oh, yeah. That has to be real.
You know, the thing that I think is interesting with all of this is that it almost kind of seems like I agree with you that she's sort of playing it out with him because she's getting to do to him what sort of the mother had done to her. It's sort of this, you know, taking it, it's her way of, I guess, maybe releasing all of the negativity and maybe all of the domination that she's receiving at the other end.
Yeah, she sees this gentleman, Singapore Sling, as a means of escape. And she has this idea in her head where that's why her mother clearly just comes in and bombards it and, quote unquote, tries to ruin it for her by torturing her even more. Because, you know, hey, you're competing for a man. You've got two bitches in heat. You know, they're tired of dry humping each other. So what are you going to do? Oh, there's a dude. Let's fight to the death. You know, I see that shit all the time in Philadelphia. So why not in this film?
It sounds like a nature film, you know, where it's like the two females are tired of humping each other, so watch them fight to the death over the male.
Let's face it, you know, we are animals after all. We just have opposable thumbs and iPhones. That's the only difference, really. I think it's obviously, you know, competition. You know, the mother wants to have some fun with the dude as well, but the daughter is thinking, I love my mother, but at the same time, I don't want to be with her. And you can tell she loves her mother because there are scenes, like especially the scene where they're just dancing around and having a jolly old time. She loves her mother, but at the same time, she resents her mother. She probably blames her mother for the father's death. Therefore, she wants to be with Singapore Sling. She thinks that he'll take her away as long as she just keeps saying, I'm Laura. I swear to you, I'm Laura. I've just been gone. I didn't know I was dead. I didn't get a newspaper. My radio's broken. My bad. So, and the mother sees that, well, you can't leave. I'm not going to let you. And that's when, you know, you even learn more of the dynamic between the mother and the daughter.
You know, Rob, you brought up John Waters when we were talking about this. And hearing this conversation where we're talking about golden showers, Roman showers, all this kind of, you know, interesting behavior, It definitely sounds very John Waters, but we really can't stress enough just how beautiful the film is and just how lovely it's shot. I mean, it's this gorgeous black and white, and it's a rare film that looks as good as this one does.
Oh, yeah, and that's why I said it looks very much of the era, and that's why I gave it the nod to Guy Madden, because Madden's one of those filmmakers who, if he's going to make a film that looks like the 20s, it looks like it just came off the shelf from 1923. It's no joke. I mean, like, you look at Gimli Hospital, you look at Careful, which we did an episode on. I mean, those movies look like they were made in that time, even though they were made 70 years later. And to me, this is very much the same. It looks like somebody doing really beautiful black and white work, circa, like, you know, mid-40s, late-40s, which fits right in with Laura and the whole Otto Preminger thing. The other aspect of which, it was John Waters directing Grey Gardens, shot by Guy Madden. That's what it is. That's where I came from. Crazy Mother and Daughter, directed by John Waters with sexual perversity, but it looked beautiful.
I really enjoyed it at first before I realized, when I first watched it, before I realized it was shot in 1990, I honestly thought it was shot much earlier. And I think it's because how everything was carried, the music, the clothing, how they did some of the dialogue. I thought it was just badass. I really enjoyed it when I read that. I was 10 years old when it came out. I was like, oh, no shit. I like it.
Yeah, after doing it back to back of this and Laura and then this again, that damn music has been stuck in my head like all day. I'm like whistling Laura's theme as I'm at work today.
I haven't gotten there yet. Just give me at least two more viewings of that movie, and I probably will be there as well.
Well, I just wanted to let you know that this evening I ate a lonely dinner by myself, and then I got in the tub to read. So I just wanted to let you know that's my alibi.
Oh, you should have gotten in the tub to write, though, with your typewriter on a board across the tub.
We're going to take a break and play back an interview with a professor who is sort of an authority on Greek film, Vrasidas Karlas, after these messages.
Everyone wants to spice things up in the bedroom. Here's an offer you won't want to miss. For a limited time, you'll get 50% off just about any one item at adamandeve.com. Yes, get 50% off when you use the coupon code BOOTH at checkout, as in John Wilkes Powers or the Projection Booth. But that's not all. You'll also receive 3 free adult DVDs and free shipping on your entire order. Too good to be true? It's not. Check out adamandeve.com today for this special offer. Once again, that coupon code is BOOTH at adamandeve.com.
You love midnight movies, don't you? But can you handle midnight movies 24 hours a day?
Your death will be indescribable.
Find out on Black Flag TV. The first viral television on the web. Black Flag TV is entirely dedicated to haunting horror, science fiction, and cult movies. Broadcasting live, 24 hours a day, obscure independent movies and classic horror. Make Black Flag TV your sanctuary for the horror genre.
They're coming to get you, Barbara.
Visit us now, blackflag.tv.
We interrupt our program with a special bulletin.
Okay, here we go. This is it.
Greetings and salutations.
I'm Josh Gravel.
And I'm Scott LaFave.
Oh, good for you!
We want to let you know about the Arkham Film Society.
We're a small group of cinephiles programming classic, horror, cult, and exploitation film events in the Providence, Rhode Island area.
We have such sights to show you.
We try to meet a need for unconventional programming by providing affordable film events through our monthly screening series.
Be one of us.
Find us on Facebook and join our group by searching for the Arkham Film Society at facebook.com/Arkham Screening.
Join us.
Check out our blog at arkhamfilmsociety.blogspot.com.
And stop by our Etsy and buy stuff at etsy.com/people/Arkham Screening.
Yes, sir! You, sir! All right, already, I'm hip!
We now return control of your television set to you.
This is Jamie from Devour the Podcast. Do you enjoy horror commentary with straightforward honesty?
Oh my God, this movie. This movie's so hard.
Oh my goodness. You know, halfway through this movie, I was just like, let's get this thing going.
This movie.
humor and an obvious passion for the genre.
Like, you're good, baby. I'll kick him in the face.
I like the cut of your jib. The ceiling, Grandma. Don't make me get out the broom. Oh, your tears are like wine. They used to call that the vapors. Cupcakes are kind of the Schindler's List of desserts. It's a pure good. I love the idea of up-and-coming horror directors taking on the found footage genre. I really, really like that idea.
And that's really the worst sin you can commit as far as filmmaking is concerned, is making a film that's just average.
Well, that doesn't really inspire any kind of discussion, whether it's, you know, to rip it apart or praise it.
Then you should spend time with David and me.
And Bo.
As we discuss horror films from old classics.
Deep Red. Empire of the Ants. Lisa and the Devil. The Baby. The Toxic Avenger.
The New Favorites.
Absentia. Cabin in the Woods. The Loved Ones. Shadow of Death. VHS. The Woman.
Check us out on iTunes or at devourthepodcast.blogspot.com. Devour the Podcast is a proud member of the Horrorphilia Podcasting Network.
The state of Greek cinema seems to be just kind of one of that, you know, the state. How has the Greek government affected Greek cinema?
In the past, very adversely, I would say. It was a great enemy of Greek cinema in the beginning, until the very early 80s. Greek government wanted always to control the system, especially the independent cinemas that we had for almost 70 years in the country. Most cinematographers, as you understand, were all of left-wing leanings. They were all sort of a kind of subversive elements. And most of them came out of the generation which we call the generation after the Civil War. So most of them, as you understand, were suspicious, were suspects to the eyes of power in Greece. In 1967, we had another sort of a kind of misdemeanor or catastrophe, if you prefer, in the country with the dictatorship. The dictatorship was much more sort of a kind of oppressive and, in most occasions, violently oppressive over the system of cinemas, which essentially they destroyed it. But after 1974 and the restoration of the Republic, which is the period that Nikolaidis appears for the first time, we had an explosion of different, if I may say, styles, cinematic styles and languages in the country, which lasts to this day. Of course, recently, as you know, because of the crisis, the financial crisis, and the collapse, the absolute collapse in the funding from the point of view of the state, you know, most Greek cinema is still produced, but outside Greece. The most important of them, of the modern contemporary directors, Lanthimos, produces his films in London, others in Paris, or in other cities of Europe. We must not forget that Greece still belongs to the European Union, so they have funding through the usual channels of the European Union.
Seems like kind of a switch, because reading your book, it seems like there were a lot of outside filmmakers that came to Greece, or just this kind of infusion.
As you understand, there was no such a thing as a sort of kind of an independent tradition in the country. It has to come from outside, and most very important directors, the most important of all, if you remember, was Jules Dassin, in this case, from America, with his ideas about film noir and these kind of things from the 50s, this tradition of the American, the glory days of film noir in the United States, came and helped the production in Greece. In the 60s, we have a very prolific, you know, it was the most prolific period of Greek cinema, which reinvented, I would say, what cinematically would be called Greek. And then we had the most internationally successful film of Greek tradition, Zorba the Greek, which is, of course, not very Greek, because first of all, the main character, Anthony Quinn, was American, and the film was not for the Greek audience, as you understand, it was the international audience. But Greek cinema was always an open space for experimentation. That was the interesting thing. Many people came in, helped the Greek locals, stayed in the country, created a specific way of looking at the Mediterranean light. The most important of all, and I think probably the most important Greek cinematographer, is an Englishman called Walter Lassalle, who belonged to the new British cinema of the 60s, but he found his, I believe, his cinematic voice with Greece, in Greece, after Zorba the Greek and the films he made in the country. So it was an open space. People came in, helped the locals. They created a hybrid visual language between the local and the transnational. And I think that's a very important aspect of the cinematic production in the country.
You watched a ton of movies for A History of Greek Cinema. As you were watching all of these films for your book, what kind of themes did you see kind of coming up all, time and time again as you kind of looked at Greek cinema overall?
It's very hard to find a common theme. We didn't have a school, a specific school in Greece of cinematic school or stylistic tradition or even a sort of a kind of an organized a sort of a group of cinematographers. Most of these films were made in a sort of a kind of out of the enthusiasm and the dedication of certain people who sat down and said, now I will sacrifice my salary and I'll sacrifice my savings in the bank to make a film. And that's exactly what happened. Actually, this is exactly what happened for 60 years, at least. So the more common theme I can see is an attempt to understand what was happening in the changing political realities of the country. Most Greek films were and still are political, even if they look highly symbolic, and if they look highly, sort of, if I may say, in most occasions, allegorical, like the films by Angelopoulos, Theo Angelopoulos, probably the most important Greek director, they are very, very political. Now, you will ask me, of course, everything is political, and of course, even the most innocuous film can be interpreted politically, but the context was so political for the making of the film was so political because most of these directors were persecuted by censorship. First of all, censorship was very strong in Greece until 1982. And the state was always intervening in what we'd produced, and most importantly, in how the films, where the films could be distributed. The distribution circuit in Greece was always controlled by the state, and that was a very important problem for most cinematographers. So the most common theme, therefore, is politics, and why the society Greek society was so unstable, so fluid, so, if I may say, in many occasions, so hostile to the Greeks themselves. The other theme that I can see, but it's not very strong. The other thing I can see is an attempt to create what we call a local language, a local visual language for cinematic representation. Because when you see an Italian film, especially in the 50s after the war, you understand that this is not simply of the language, because of the sensitivity, the lighting, the way that the camera actually stands in front of action, and of course by the way that the story itself unfolds. It took us many, many decades to construct in Greece a complete story. In Greece, we didn't have a tradition of schools for script writing. We don't have, if I may say, good script writers to this day. We can't find from outside or import them or or bring them from other countries to try to work with the locals in order to teach the Greek cinematographers how to write good scripts. So that's a serious problem, as you understand, in the country. That's why we don't have, except Zorba, a good cinematic character in Greece. Finally, as you see, there's something very important. We don't have religious movies. We don't have fantasy movies. We don't have classical fantasy movies in Greece, which is even the absence of these films shows something very important for the country, I would say, and refers to its self-definition, how the country itself defined its identity vis-a-vis its own past.
Now, you mentioned Angelopoulos. Who are some of the other major characters when it comes to, or major players when it comes to Greek cinema? Who do you see else as being an important figure?
Angelopoulos, as you understand, is an auteur. He belongs to a very limited audience of art lovers, cinephiliacs, and he has an audience which is restricted, but his films themselves are, I believe, films for other directors, less for the wider audiences. I think the most successful Greek director to this day is Nikos Koundouros. Nikos Koundouros, who made this famous film called The Ogre of Athens in 1955, and which I believe is the best Greek film, and continued later on some films about the Civil War, the Daphnis and Chloe, the most important experimental Greek film called Vortex or The Eyes of Medusa, 1968. They were all banned by the dictatorship. But later on, after the restoration of the Republic, he made some films like 1922, like Bordello, very provocative films in this case, like Nikolaidis' films in some aspects. Kakogiannis, of course, the man who made Zorba the Greek, but not for Zorba the Greek itself, but for his previous films, where in which, during the 50s in particular, he made what we call single-handedly Greek realism. He created through two films Greek realism for cinema. And of course, his magnificent, probably the best ever throughout the world recreation of ancient Greek tragedy, with his Electra in 1962. Nikolaidis and the others, like Kostas Feris, like Tonia Marketaki, like Lanthimos most recently, and Panos Koutras, are very good directors who created completely different styles. They have their own style of representation, which shows this variety and diversity that we've got in Greek cinema. Therefore, as you understand, the inability in most occasions to find a common ground for all these different languages, visual languages that we have in the country. But after Angelopoulos, I would say Koundouros, Kakogiannis, Nikolaidis, according to my perception, especially in his earliest films, he's an extremely competent and able director, and I think he deserves more attention worldwide. And women like Tonia Marketaki, very few people pay attention to her work, and from the experimental cinema, Antoinetta Angelidou, one of the most, I think, her work must be discovered at a certain stage worldwide, because it stands as the same level as Maya Deren and the other experimental cinematographers from the States, Canada, and Europe.
So where do you kind of see Nikolaidis fitting in or not when it comes to the overall Greek cinema? What does he kind of represent, a new movement of filmmakers, or where does he fit into the history a little bit?
From the beginning, from his first film, was a bit what we call in Greek an irregular verb. You couldn't fit him in any tradition. You couldn't find any place for him within the political films of the 70s or the very sort of a kind, if I may say, mythological films that we had in the 80s or later on the very gritty, realistic films that we had in the 90s and afterwards. Nikolaidis was a director that always privileged the imaginary, the subconscious, the implicit, the subtexts within a society. He never made grand statements about politics, about society, about faith or faithlessness. His main project, I think, was always, from the first film, which was called Eurydice, was to explore what is happening in the subconscious mind of individuals, to bring it out to the light of conscience, to actually elucidate it through cinematic means, make it sort of a kind, if I may say, fluid in front of our eyes. His cinema was both, if I may say, delusion, in the sense that how Deleuze describes cinema to be, as a flow image, images that flow in front of your eyes, and at the same time highly symbolic, to the extent that at the end of his life he made these three hyper-realistic films, where the line between realism and anti-realism is completely blurred. You don't understand although it starts with something completely palpable and tangible, you understand that he's talking now with something which is totally imaginary. The conversations that we see being encoded in his films are about people that do not really exist, but they are potentialities in our own minds. They are suppressed desires. He made par excellence, I would say, not Freudian cinema, but Lacanian cinema, a subconscious which is structured like language. That's why he explores the limits of language by dragging his films to the extreme, sort of the extremes of visual representation, by stretching the visual representation to meaninglessness.
Yeah, I just recently rewatched Yuri Dizet, and I have to say, it reminded me a lot of Repulsion, just that way that we have a character kind of trapped in one space and kind of trapped in her own head, too.
Yeah, that's it. These essentially are, that explains the theatricality of most of his films as well. But Eurydice is essentially a reinterpretation of an ancient Greek myth, that Eurydice is in the underworld and she's waiting for Orpheus to come, but in reality she gets enamored by the underworld and she doesn't want to get up by Hades and she doesn't want to go up. And this is a very interesting film in this case, from that point of view, because it showed, you must see that within the context of 1973, we had political unrest in the country, and suddenly you have a film which talks about your subconscious desires, about repression, about personal dead ends, existential impasses, which I think that actually back then created a lot of, if I may say, criticism by the Greeks and a lot of negative sort of approach to his works. Later on, he continued, of course, with A Sweet Bunch, I think, one of his best films, one of the best films of the Greek cinema. I think if we could say that, just Angelopoulos made with the Traveling Players is number one, this Sweet Bunch, this Lykas Moria, is number three or four, because the film explored all these hidden subgroups in Greek society. The people that were never political, the people who lived on the margins of society, people who were persecuted, people who were essentially marginalized because of their own individuality. And he made that through this glaring, almost cinemascope colors, if you remember in that film, and with American music, which was back then in an era of politicization, was another provocation to the political orthodoxy of the country, and created, if I may say, desperados, people who wanted to commit suicide, who preferred death instead of living, for people who actually didn't want to exist in a society where there was no place, as Nicolaides himself said, for friendship, love, and affection. And this is something, it sounds a bit sort of a sentimental, but within the context was very provocative, confronting, and highly, I would say, revolutionary, according to my perception.
It's kind of amazing to me that he worked for so long, but he really only directed 11 films.
Yes.
Why was there such a gap between?
First of all, he was a perfectionist, I think. Then, as you notice, most of his films were independent productions. He didn't want to be funded by the Greek state. And he didn't want to be funded by the Greek state because he knew that, the one who gives you the money wants always to control your script. He wants to control how you produce and produce a film. And they would have been responsible for its distribution as well. He preferred to remain a marginal, lonely voice instead of being entangled within this, diabolical machinations that we see in the funding programs of a state. And that's why he made only 11 films. Most of them, as you not say, very independent. He tried to save the money himself to make them, and he didn't want the state to be involved at all. And that's why he remains a suspect till the last day of his life. On the other hand, his themes, his stories, are very confronting. Nobody wants to get involved with this kind of dark cinema that we see in Singapore Sling. It's disgusting cinema, as somebody said in the country when the film came out. It's cinema that essentially not simply provokes but repulses people from the cinemas themselves. But in reality, they represent, I believe, in-depth archetypal experiments probing the limits of what is permissible and what is impermissible, what is understood and what is not understood. And X actually himself brings us into this realm of the numinous in human sexuality, of what is, or the mysterious element in human sexuality, with the main locus of epiphany being the female body.
You brought a lot of political rhetoric to when you were talking about Sweet Bunch. What kind of politics do you see in Singapore Sling? Is it just this kind of politics of the female?
Well, now it is the politics of the human body now, because now we have gone beyond, as you understand, the ideological politics of the 70s and the 80s. Now the main political battleground was and still remains the human body, who controls our consciousness, our bodily, our corporeality in a modern capitalist society, that everything has been commodified, everything has become sold, everything can become a commodity in itself. So I think this is a political element. He exposes that. He makes it, he brings it to its extremes, and by inflating it so much, shows that people react to this at the end, and they react in a very sort of a guttural way, that this is not the way that we see the human body. The human body is something that you see constantly, of course, in his films, beautiful, something attractive, something that you want to be part of it, to you know, just commune with it, not simply erotically, but that, because, as he said, the most important virtue in a human relationship is affection. This incredible love that he has, and you can see that with the cinematography of Ari Stavrou, for example, in Singapore Sling, for the human body, for the female body in particular, because the male body is absent. Singapore Sling is a heterosexual Pasolini Salo. He's trying to create a sort of a counter Pasolini, I believe, sexual extravaganza in that film, close to the Bataille, because he loved a lot French theory of cinema, especially Bataille and then Deleuze, the divine filth, the excremental sublime, everything that mainstream cinema had rejected, Nikolaidis used it in the last three films he made.
It's funny that you bring up Pasolini, because our co-host on this episode was on the show that we did on Salo quite a few months ago.
Well, Salo is, as you understand, one of the masterpieces, should I call it masterworks, of European cinema, which is doomed to be ignored, not to be talked about, precisely because of its confronting stories that we see in the film. But in reality, it is one of the most complex, much more provocative, revolutionary, much more interesting films produced in Italy and in Europe, especially after the grand disillusionment with the socialist parties, with all ideologies that we see emerging from the 70s onwards. So it's a film, I believe, that has influenced many Greek directors as well. But as you see, Nikolaidis could not make such films in the 70s or 80s in Greece, although we had some peculiar minor films and marginal films by some directors in the 70s, like Pasolini's. But I believe that this is a film that responds to Pasolini by privileging the female body in this case, not the male body. It's the missing, as you notice in this film by Nikolaidis, what is missing at the end is the Lacanian sense of phallus. There's no phallus in this film. On the contrary, you see the gradual feminization of the only male character that we see in this film. Don't forget that the main character in Laura by Otto Preminger was an obvious homosexual back then, a gay character, the first overtly gay character that we see in a film noir, 1945 already. Nikolaidis plays with this sort of a transgender situation. The man, the male character, doesn't have a phallus. What he has instead is a knife. And he stabs as if in the last scene of the film, as if he's having sex, not with his penis, but with his knife, the main character, the female character, and kills her or makes her bleed, as you see. Well, as he dies, as himself dies. But it is, the film works with these inversions, Freudian inversions, based on the idea that now the female, that we're entering the period of femininity, I believe. That he say it is something that Nicolaides himself believed, that the next century will be the century of women. And that's exactly a thing that what he explored in that film.
Well, it's interesting that you bring up the knife replacement and the feminization of the character. As you're saying that, immediately Norman Bates jumps to mind from Psycho, and it's like, oh yeah, I can kind of see some connections there other than just the black and white cinematography.
Of course, I mean, the whole film, Singapore Sling, is a sort of a kind of dialogue with all this, the Hollywood film noir and films by Hitchcock, because, as you see, we have the voiceover, somebody talks to the camera, there's a overt theatricality, everything becomes really, really, if I may say, a sort of a kind of replica, a substitute of other films, and the film itself becomes a film about films, not about reality. And you can see this intertextual palimpsestic quality of the film itself. The film works through references to other films. It creates a, if I may say, a cinematic mythology, a mythology about cinema. It works on the basis that cinema itself has created the modern way of thinking, in reality, the modern way of seeing reality. And that's an experiment of how we see reality. He tried to peel off, to take off, that is to say, I believe, with Singapore Sling, from the eyes of his audience, the fears, the phobias, the anxieties about the rise of women as agents of change and of action in contemporary society.
What do you think about the use of language in the film? It's so interesting to me that you have the mother who's bilingual and then Singapore Sling, who is not really understood by anybody. You've got the sign language and then you've got the main character speaking English. What do you kind of make of all that?
And the narration is in Greek as well, as you remember. You know, it's a bit funny, as you see, because I think what he's trying to show is that the linguistic tradition that we have in France in that period, from France, and he was influenced by that movement of structuralism, that language itself communicates beyond its articulation. You don't have to know French or you don't have to know English in order to understand what the other is saying. I think that he essentially abolishes any idea. This is, I believe, the meaning of this sort of a multilingualism that we see there, that every situation has its own language which transcends the linguistic articulations we knew so far about it, about each one of about the situation itself. So essentially what he's trying to show is that there's no such a thing as national cinema anymore. We can't base national cinema on linguistic presuppositions or on linguistic criteria. He changed completely this because these people communicate in different languages. They understand each other because it doesn't matter what they say. What is important is what they do. That's why they speak mostly to the camera. The camera itself is the ideal interlocutor. They talk with the camera. They're in a dialogue with the camera, therefore with the audience, and before the audience, with the director himself. But I believe that the film itself tries to abolish the sense of national cinema, national borders, creates for the first time this transculturality that we see in European cinema, especially in that period, in the late 80s, early 90s. The film was made in 1990, as you understand, just when communism collapsed in Eastern Europe. That's another subtext of the film. It's there. That's why everything happens in a confined space. It happens within essentially one house, one room, one or two rooms, if I remember well. And everything moves within that space, full of if I may say, sort of a kind of relics from the past, from of symbols of the past, clothes, references to the bourgeois fantasies of the 19th century and the early 20th century. And that's another political element that we see in the film itself. Plus the clothes that are very important in this film, they are essentially, they carnivalize, if I may use a term by Bakhtin, the way that they clothe themselves show your identity and your social class within traditional film noir and traditional cinema itself. They make fun of that. They make it a carnivalesque sort of a spectacle. That's why most of them wear sort of a bizarre clothes. The man at the end wears this incredibly ambiguous clothes, something between imperial clothes and something between a sort of a kind of a cabaret, you know, just attire ready to be thrown away and remain naked. So I think that's the other part of the film itself, which is very worth mentioning. And I believe the other thing, as you understand, is that with the food, the scenes of food that we see in the film itself, they eat and they vomit. The most important moment that they have, supposedly they have to have sex, they start vomiting on each other, which is a very interesting aspect in this case, I believe, of the film itself, because the film itself does not hesitate to ridicule all the bourgeois rituals of good manners. And it becomes, in that case, a very political film, in a sense that they, in an era of, especially in Greece in that period, that decency and good manners prevailed, he completely exposes, subverses, and completely destroys these sort of protocols of bourgeois behavior.
How was Singapore Sling received when it was released?
Yeah, although it received a lot of awards in Greece and one award, I think, in London, it was essentially, not officially, but de facto, it was banned. It was screened only in Greece only for 1 week or 2 weeks, I think, in one cinema, and then it was taken down and disappeared afterwards. In England, it was not even allowed to be released, and to this day, I think, remains one of the few films banned from being screened in England, except, as you understand, in the British Film Institute for the aficionados of cinema itself. In France, it was very successful, because the French immediately understood all these subtexts, especially French critics. And in Italy, Germany didn't allow the screening of the film. And in Greece to this day, it has been shown only once or twice ever since. Not many people watch it anymore because, as you understand, it represents a past of revolutionary and radical critique that nobody wants to remember anything of to this day.
It's the only film of his that has been, at least legally, released in the United States. Why do you think that that's the one out of his body of work that has kind of crossed over?
I really don't know. That's one of the enigmas. I would like to ask you about this, because I think the film that should have been best for the American cinema, the American audience, is The Sweet Bunch, essentially. It makes a very interesting reference to The Wild Bunch, as you remember, and that's very interesting. But his other films, as we see, I believe the latest, the films he made after Singapore Sling, were equally sort of provocative, especially The Loser Takes It All and The 0 Years, were very provocative to be released. Actually, in Greece, they were not even released for the wider audiences. It was shown only, you know, on upper perspectives and these kind of things. America is a very strange market, as you know, and sometimes the unexpected happens. It's like, as you know, Angelopoulos films, only one film has been screened in America, The Landscape in the Mist, and a bit of The Ulysses Gaze, only because Harvey Keitel was on that. I think that remains to be interrogated. I really don't know why this film was the only one released. I believe that his previous film, The Morning Patrol, which is about a post-apocalyptic sort of a kind city, will be very interesting. It was made in 1987 for the American audience, but especially Sweet Bunch, which I believe is one of the crowning achievements of his visual style. Probably it has to do with the fact, as I said, that he made all his films as independent productions, and it's very difficult for independent producers to find a distributor worldwide, especially internationally. And he didn't have an agent himself to promote his works. I think that's the practicality behind the whole thing. On the other hand, I believe that his films, and this one, of course, is one of the most provocative. I don't know how successful they could have been in the States, in an era especially of Reagan and Bush and even the Clinton years, as you understand, because the family values were dominant for a long period in the country. And the radical movement of the 70s was all but lost in that period.
So I have to commend you on your book. Your book is excellent. I like that it's both very studious, but also very accessible as well. I didn't feel like you were talking down to your audience at all. I felt very engaged with the whole thing and just kind of really kind of devoured it. It was great to get into this area of cinema that I had never really had a chance to explore before, and just that really, again, didn't seem to ever kind of cross over the pond. I mean, it's not like, other than Dogtooth, I can't think of another Greek film that has been released in the last few years.
Yeah, thank you so much for what you say. I try to make it accessible, avoiding jargon or any other, you know, specificities that would be interesting for a Greek audience, but not for an international audience. This is a book written for an international audience to give an overall representation of Greek cinema. What happened? Who were the best directors? What were the best works? And trying to provide a commentary on how they produced and the dialogue they were actually, it was that was developed between them. Because these films, because they are achievements, I would call them, of lonely individuals, isolated individuals, were in an implied dialogue with each other. They created the dialectics of personal experience or history of emotions in the country, which is very important to be examined and I think explored further. I'm trying to write a second book based on specific directors in this case. Nikolaidis will be one of them because I'm very interested in his intellectual, I would say, trajectory and his visual, of course, cinematic trajectory, how he started from from the beginning as a complete irregularity within the context of Greek cinema. He provoked, he challenged, he confronted, he was this incredible, he was the perennial adolescent, the spirit of rebellion that was never satisfied with what he did before, and he wanted to do something more provocative, even something more, I would say, that would challenge his own limits as well. This is the important thing about Nikolaidis, and this is the important thing about Greek cinema, not being so regularized or being so controlled, allowed these voices to exist and produce their own films without any assistance or any help, but they produce them. And the production themselves expresses, I believe, one of the most important promises that we see today now in a Greek cinema that is in ruins, that is trying to relocate itself vis-a-vis European cinema and tries to redefine its past. I think now that this is happening at the moment, that the process of redefining its past will bring Nikolaidis back to the fore, and we'll see his deep and permanent contribution to the establishment of a visual language, a visual tradition, not simply in Greece, but in Europe as such, because he belongs to that great tradition, I would say, starting with Pasolini, Liliana Caviani, with Fassbinder, with all these great rebellious spirits of the 70s and 80s. And he was the only one who continued until 2007 when he died. His films represent that radical potential of European cinema that I believe that still stands to this day without having lost anything after 30 years of its production.
Now, have you always been interested in Greek cinema?
No, my real... I was always interested in Russian cinema, to be honest. my real love, or my deepest love, is Eisenstein, the cinema of Eisenstein, and whom I believe that, he's especially, not simply his films, which are superb, of course, but his aesthetics of cinema are very close to my heart, and I think that he helped me always to explore reality to understand cinematic reality better than any other framework of reference. But I love Russian cinema, and actually my next book after I finish this on Greek cinema will be on Eisenstein himself and the way that he presented the human face in his films. And of course I liked American cinema. Who doesn't like American cinema, especially especially if I may say the 30s, the cinema of the 30s and the 40s, especially the early film noirs, because I think that the best production, the best films ever made in the American cinema are these film noirs, of especially starting with Laura and other films of the same period, which I think that we appreciate them, but for the wrong reasons in some occasions. We lose the political element in them. We don't see the visual rebellion that they actually encapsulate and embody, with the representation of the human body and the human of clothes, the way that the dress sense that the people are, and of course the great mystery, because the real protagonist of this film, in these films, is always either the city or, in this case, you know, the confined spaces, the black and white confined spaces. And of course, my love from American cinema is John Cassavetes. I believe that he's a great director, and I would like, last year I gave a lecture at a course at Sydney University on his work, and it was very successful.
So why did you decide to tackle the history of Greek cinema then?
First of all, nothing had been written on that topic. Then I believe it's very interesting to present something like that, because especially in the moments of crisis, I think it was my duty to my tradition to write something like that, because at this moment I want to show what the Greeks had achieved, what actually achieved, despite the collapse and catastrophes that they have the catastrophes that they have experienced. They have made some very important contributions to world cinema, and that's exactly what I wanted to bring to the awareness of the wider public. And of course, as you dig into this past, you get enamored and you want to search for more and more, as you understand, because it becomes very, really, really interesting after a while. And you get to know some people like Koundouros, like Angelopoulos, like this, and you see that they always have something to say, but very few people paid attention to them, because either because of their status as the national directors, like Angelopoulos, or the idea that they were, you know, a bit wackos and a bit, you know, just totally mad, like Koundouros or the others. So as you understand, you discover a lot of things by exploring the tradition. You discover so many interesting aspects of cinema itself that you didn't know they existed. And they were there always in front of you, and they were always there to be explored and articulated and be put forward for discussion for the general public and the general, you know, cinephilia, the people who like cinema as a whole. And I think that's exactly what I wanted to do with that book.
You've mentioned a couple titles of movies that folks should definitely check out. What were some of the other things that you discovered? You know, what were some of the hidden gems that you uncovered while you're doing your research?
Well, you know, there was a Greek film of 1930, for example, you know, Daphnis and Chloe, which essentially was the first, presented the first male nudity in European cinema, 1930. And it's very interesting. It's a silent film, the last silent film produced in the country. It's for the visual sort of aspect of the whole, the visual style of the whole representation. Then, of course, it is Kakoyannis' Stella, one of the most successful Greek films, but it belongs to social realism. Kakoyannis' Electra, the most important, I think, symbolic, hyper-realistic film based on ancient Greek tragedy that we have seen in world cinema to this day. I believe that the films by Nikolaidis deserve more attention. The films by women like Antonia Marketaki, very few people pay attention to her, or Antoinetta Angelidou as experimental cinema per se, and films by Koundouros, as I said before, by Panayotopoulos. There are many good filmmakers in Greece. There's a filmmaker, Kanellopoulos, for example, who lived in the 60s and 70s, who produced most of his films 60s and 70s, which have poetic reflections of the human experience, like the films by Jean Cocteau. So they bring a completely different, as you understand, understanding of the cultural production in the country itself, of because they represent something unique, something important. You think that most Greek films are about the Mediterranean Sea, about the light, about the sun, they're all dancing like zorbas and these kind of things. But there's a profound melancholy in the Greek films of the same period, a profound sadness about the human, their adventure, about the human adventure in life. And I think this is a very important aspect of Greek cinema that it deserves to be explored. And it's a cinema, as you understand, that it reinvented itself constantly. It didn't have every 5 years we had seen new voices emerging, new stylistic innovation, sort of a kind of representations, new forms of visual inframing of reality. Every 5 years, if you go one by one, you will see that from the 50s onwards, when we had a studio system, you know, a good studio system in Greece established, we have an amazing and incredible and sometimes surprising sense of constant innovation, which I believe is one of the most important elements that you will see, and you can find in an overall peripheral cinema without capital, as you say. Cinema without money, they have to find their own money. So every 5 years, you have a completely new movement made based on one or two people themselves, and then which was replaced by another one, by another one, by another one. And that shows, I believe, the incredible sort of the cultural potential that we see in this cinematic tradition, which has been unexplored and completely, if I may say, neglected or overlooked by many people to this day.
Well, I'm very grateful that you're pointing this out, but I'm also kind of angry at you because now it sounds like I have to track down a whole lot of more films.
Thank you. That's very important, isn't it? You know, because as you see, Greek cinema is, you know, just such a small country, but it produced within 70 years at least 7,000 films. This is an immense amount for the country. In the 60s and 70s, Greek film studios were producing at least 400 films per year. Hollywood produced 700 films per year in that period. As you see, comparatively and proportionally, Greece was producing more films given its population. But they were all equally successful at the box office. They were all, the Greeks were great cinema goers. They loved the experience of going to the cinema. So I hope that the book tried to rekindle that spirit, as you understand, because I believe it's very important to go to the films, to see the movies, to have the experience of sort of of the collective, if I may say, vertical sort of a kind of social space where there are no class distinctions, where there are no differences between people, and they all watch the same, are all exposed to the same film in front of them.
Yeah, we're all the same people in the dark, right?
Exactly, exactly.
The thing that really kind of took me by surprise was when you were reporting some of the films that were popular in different years, just how many pornographic films were popular throughout the history.
Yeah, of course, of course. It's very interesting, as you see, this soft porn films that were produced in Greece from the 60s onwards, especially under the eyes of a dictatorship. And the dictatorship itself, you know, just although they believe in family values and Christian principles and this kind of thing, allow all these films to actually be produced and being screened and became very successful. Most Greeks watch this sort of a kind of porn films. The porn films themselves were, to this day, if you watch some of them, are extremely funny because beyond the sexual, if I may say, sort of a titillation, they work with a specific sort of a kind of use of language. The sexual innuendos and the sexual ambiguities in the way that the language is used in these films is much more important than the nudity that you see in these films. They are, you know, just you see, for example, naked women, but you never see a completely naked man. The penis is always the hidden god of these films. Nobody exposes this male nudity in these films. The films themselves are very funny, and extremely, I would say, in this case, they become like a sort of a kind of spoofs on the tradition of producing porn films. They have created a very important, I would say, sort of a kind of punchlines in Greek. We use them to this day. On the other hand, the very important aspect of these porn films, they were very successful, and some of them, the money that came out, you know, from the box office, was used to produce high art films at the same period, because some of the directors and some of the cinematographers, some of the cameramen and the others worked for this industry, and they took money from there in order to fund their own, you know, much more artistic or much more socially engaged films. So it's very interesting to see how popular culture or low art actually influences and subsidizes high art.
We're back, and we're talking about Singapore Sling with our special guest, co-host Fraulein Von B. So it was great talking about Greek cinema with Professor Karolis. You know, kind of an overlooked area of cinema, and really my very slight exposure to Greek cinema is through Nikolaitis' work. I mean, I've seen a few of his films. Have you guys seen much Greek film?
I don't think I've seen that much Greek film, but I'd have to say that probably this is a very singular work. Out that Greek cinema is full of the kind of perversity and strangeness and overall beauty of image that we have in this work.
I would like to think that, but then, you know, I mentioned Dogtooth earlier, and that's like one of the only other Greek films that I've seen, and that one was kind of up too. But yeah, after reading the professor's book, there's definitely a whole wide world of Greek film out there, and yeah, I'm kind of looking to check it out. It's definitely more than just Zorba the Greek.
Yeah, I would have to say that you know, if you ask anyone, it would be like, hey, Greek film, and they would say, oh yeah, of course, Anthony Quinn,
who played like every ethnicity under the sun, even Asian, I think he played.
And it's not bad for a guy who's a Mexican.
I want to talk a little bit more as far as, I guess we should have done this while you were off the phone, Fraulein, since you didn't get a chance to watch Lore, but I want to talk a little bit more about the connections between Singapore Sling and Laura, because really, like I said, the more I watch it, the more I kind of got that. I didn't even really pick up the first couple times when they were making references to the older film, and I don't know if that was just me being dumb or what it was, but now when I watch it, it's just like, oh yeah. I mean, there are snatches of dialogue that are direct lifts from the Preminger film.
You've been holding out, and I want to know why.
What are you trying to do? Force a confession out of me.
What are you trying to do? Force a confession out of me.
Who are you covering up for?
What difference does it make what I say? You've made up your mind I'm guilty. You know I didn't kill anyone.
You've made up your mind I'm guilty.
Are you?
Don't tell me you have any doubts. Since you... Oh, I can't, please. Do I have to have those lights in my face?
Then why did you tell me the radio at the lake house was broken?
Because... Do I have to have those lights in my face?
Why did you tell me the radio at your country place was broken?
Because it was broken.
Not when I tried it.
I really think that it's a very clever homage to the older film.
Absolutely, especially when a comment was made about the investigator being in love with a corpse.
You better watch out, McPherson, or you'll end up at a psychiatric ward. I don't think they've ever had a patient who fell in love with a corpse.
And where in the film, the daughter / Laura says, you see, you don't have to be in love with Cork, you know, because I'm right here. So, yeah, that was the connection that I have received when saw bits and pieces and actually read a synopsis of the film.
Yeah, I have to say that Singapore Sling is definitely a little bit removed from Dana Andrews.
Just a little, just a smidge.
One thing that kind of overrides both, and it's more of a background as opposed to being one lead person, is the idea of obsession and being obsessed with things. I mean, obviously, Laura is all about one character who's obsessed with the title character. But Singapore Sling, it seems like at least the mother and daughter has some serious obsession issues. And although he's a detective, he seems to be very obsessed with this Laura character as well. So it seems to be a movie that all these people are fired by some sort of obsessive ideas.
Absolutely. Especially one thing that I always kept picturing, and I don't know, maybe because I was smoking at the time, about how the daughter was saying, you know, I go to the attic to smoke. Mother says never smoke. How when they were searching an unconscious Singapore Sling, she found the cigarettes in his jacket and she took those. And how she was talking to him while she was dressed as Laura. She started talking like Laura, but she said, you know, that woman out there, she doesn't allow me to smoke. And all of a sudden, she just stops. The smoking is also part of an obsession. And I think it represents the obsession of wanting to have some sort of freedom away from her mother. You know, at least if she were dead, I wouldn't have someone over my head all the time. So the smoking, to me, is also that part of that obsession. Like, it's just a symbol of, wow, if my mother weren't around, think of all the wonderful things I could do. And that towards the end, when the mother is dead, what is she doing? She's smoking. And she said, now I can smoke. Definitely in there. Key of obsession.
There's kind of a fine history of remakes of Laura. I was looking around earlier today and just seeing how many remakes there were. I mean, there was, you know, the direct remakes, direct adaptations of the same source material. And that's like, I think like 4 or 5 that have been. And then just all of the nods throughout the years to Laura. I mean, one of the biggest ones for me is Twin Peaks, you know, with Laura Palmer. And then the ending of every episode with that picture on the mantle. And then even to the point where they named the Mina bird Waldo, as in Waldo Lidecker from the film. There's even a Bollywood version called Rog, R-O-G, that I now need to track down, because I would love to see the Bollywood Laura.
For sure, they'll break out in song and dance at one point.
Oh, yeah. Laura definitely has been this tale of obsession in film, and then also people have obsessed over the film. Well, Laura's got that great music, too, that great theme. You know, I was looking around for different cover versions of that, and there's just tons of cover versions of that theme song. And then, yeah, just that that lush score that runs throughout all of Singapore Sling is just haunting melody.
Indeed.
All right, we're going to take another break and play a preview for next week's show.
We've got to warn people.
What do you see?
The Howling. Somewhere in this city, in this human jungle, it begins.
What do you see?
What's there, Karen?
What do you see, Karen?
What's there, Karen?
Somewhere in these woods, in this primal, sensuous, secret place, lies an experience too terrifying for words. And now, all anyone can do is watch and wait.
Nine, I'm gonna show you something. Make you believe.
Thank you.
That's right. We'll be back next week with a discussion of The Howling. Joe Dante will be by to talk about it, and our old friend Josh Hadley. And we'll figure out, actually, what it takes to sit through and watch all 8 Howling films in a row. Mike did it.
It ain't easy.
And before we go, I want to thank our old friend Fraulein Von B for taking the time to talk to us about Singapore Sling. Now, what have you been up to, and what can we look forward to?
Well, what I've been up to is actually working with my Diabolique Foundation. We are having our annual ball November 23rd, which is a Saturday at Club Devotion, Devotion Nightclub in downtown Philadelphia. The Diabolique Ball 2013 will be the theme of Grindhouse Horror Show. So we are celebrating our two favorite gratuitous genres, the horror as well as Grindhouse. And I'm working on getting some very exciting, very special guests to join us. That's actually on the hush right now. And also, I am going to be collaborating with Mr. Mike White as well as Josh Hadley with Cinema, which is Sex Through the Lens, a series regarding just critiquing the wonderful world of pornographic film from the 70s, 80s, 90s, and present, as well as hopefully joining you two again for other interviews and synopses of finer film.
Yeah, and it's always great to have you stop by. We had a lot of fun on the solo episode.
For the whole family.
Oh, and we've gotten some great comments. Like, people really enjoyed the solo episode and loved having you on, so we just had to have you back.
Oh, well, absolutely. I'm more than happy to join in and give my 2 cents, or perhaps a little bit more. But absolutely, I really did enjoy Solo. I've also enjoyed Singapore Sling. And again, it happens to be now one of my most heavily rotated films in my home. And I'm looking forward to also seeing Nikos Nikolaitis' other films. So this is also very good schooling for me as well.
So what does it say about you or about me that when I was thinking about Singapore Sling for the show, I said, I wonder if Fraulein Van B would like that movie?
What was I thinking? Well, I remember when you sent this to me, and I was like, oh, wow, another film. Okay, oh, Singapore Sling. And I will admit, I had put it on my shelf until one day I'd come home from work, and I thought, what the hell, I'm going to take a look at it. And all I can say is, Mike, for as short we have known each other, you seem to know me so well. The first thing I did after watching, I did watch it the first time, had my what the f*** moment, had to watch it again. And all I could think of was when I talked to you and said, oh, yes, thank you for the film, first thing I had to ask was, can we please do a rundown on this show on the projection booth? This would be f***ing excellent. I really do appreciate it. So we're peas in a pod. I really enjoyed it. I can't stress it enough. It's an excellent film, and I strongly recommend it for those who are fans of the noir genre, who are also fans of foreign languages like myself, you know, big language nerd, and listening to the Greek, the French, the English all intertwine, and just a different taste of cinema that is out there.
Well, hey, thanks again for coming on the show. And yeah, we've got a big list of other kinky / odd films that we want to talk to you about. So we'll be sure to have you back on the show coming up pretty soon.
Oh, absolutely. You just keep me posted and I will be there.
All right. And thank you for listening. And make sure to stop by the website, projection-booth.com. You can get all the information on this week's show, where to pick it up, more information on the director and all that stuff. Leave your feedback there. Also go over to iTunes, put a review up there, and leave us some stars because, you know, we're worth the love. So why not give it up freely?
Free love. That's what we're all about.
Laura is the face in the misty light. Footsteps that you hear down the hall. The that floats on a summer night that you can never quite recall.